This one is, so we've been talking today about four things, I think, that we're going to try and put together. So bounded rationality, which is a kind of common feature, power and knowledge, which is less of a common feature, narrative policy framework, and social construction and policy design. So we've tended to discuss these things fairly separately. So the idea is we can put some of these things together. So start with bounded rationality, which almost every policy concept or theory that we've talked about has some reference to bounded rationality or something like it. You know, the language changes a little bit, but it's sometimes people talk about the model of the individual or something like that. But usually the way I would introduce it is, you know, policymakers and influencers, or any policy actor, they can only process a tiny proportion of all policy relevant information. So they have to find ways to limit their attention, and they have to find ways to make choices under, you know, political and time pressures with a very small amount of information. To perform that task, they combine cognition and emotion. Now, I know that sounds very broad, but I think that's really as far as the consensus goes. If you want to be more provocative, you say, okay, they use rational and irrational cognitive shortcuts, but it's some kind of cognitive and emotional process they use to turn an almost infinite amount of information into very quick, often very quick choices. Okay, so that's the context in which we discuss things like power, because people that exercise power to help other people make those cognitive shortcuts work. Okay, so for example, they frame issues in a particular way to draw their attention of the audience to some information at the expense of the rest. Okay, so some response to bounded rationality is by the individual themselves deciding, you know, what to pay attention to, what to ignore. Some of that job is done by other people who influence them to make those choices. Okay, so as described, you should see some connections between some of the things we've talked about. One is to concepts like uncertainty and ambiguity. I like these concepts because, I mean, to be honest, if you're new to these things, it takes me forever to clarify when people ask questions, but I think they make sense to me in that I would say uncertainty is about a lack of information. You reduce uncertainty by producing more information, more evidence. Ambiguity is something else. It is about the potential to understand the world or policy problems in many different ways, to interpret issues in many different ways. So we reduce ambiguity by exercising power to frame issues and tell stories, to draw attention to one interpretation at the expense of all the others. So that is how you go from bounded rationality as a kind of cognitive limit to the exercise of power to get people to think about the world in a particular way. Okay. Another link we'll talk about, this is a nice segue, is people exercise power to generate attention and respect for some forms of evidence or knowledge at the expense of others. That's often what we're talking about. We talk about things like evidence-based policymaking. The first question we ask is, what is evidence and whose evidence counts? And that is an exercise of power to decide whose evidence matters and whose evidence or knowledge doesn't matter. Okay. So that's our segue to power and knowledge. And I think the line I like, however true it is, the line I like is that the most profound or worrying kinds of power are the hardest to observe. So the most observable are associated with pluralist methods. Okay, so you identify the most important issues in a population. You examine the political battles associated with those issues. You identify who has material resources, how they use them, and who wins. And the people that win consistently are the powerful, and the people that lose consistently are the powerless. Okay. Now, what we get into then with that kind of discussion is the idea that a lot of forms of power are exercised to ensure that those battles don't take place. You know, the big criticism of pluralist method was that it was a focus on highly visible competitions between people, whereas a lot of the exercise of power is to stop those competitions happening, to win in other ways. So it sounds like, you know, more of a form of manipulation. So what we're talking about is actors using resources, for example, to reinforce social attitudes or reinforce policymakers' beliefs. Because those beliefs help establish which issues people think are important, the issues people think are worthy of their attention, and their beliefs help establish which populations they think deserve government support or punishment. So imagine people exercise power to reinforce people's beliefs about what government should do and who they should praise and who they should punish. If so, it's possible that, you know, none of these battles play out or you know, receive any attention because, for example, not enough people think they are worthy of debate. You know, they take for granted that some populations deserve benefits and some deserve punishments. Or when they do pay attention to some issues, they're crowded out on a political agenda. Because, you know, a kind of macro political agenda, you can only consider so many issues. So you can often exercise power simply by crowding other issues out. Now, if you've been in meetings that has physically an agenda, you'll get the sense of that, where if you've got an hour to discuss a lot of things, you can only discuss so many things. And if you want to, you know, reduce attention to one thing, you populate it with a whole bunch of unimportant things to crowd out the important things. Okay, so those are the kind of mechanisms we're talking about, where you're drawing attention to a whole bunch of unimportant issues so that people don't pay attention to the important ones. Okay, so if you look at studies of power, they often relate these kind of processes to the manipulation, so I'll use that word, manipulation of ideas or shared beliefs under these conditions of bounded rationality we've talked about. So that's what we'll connect to the narrative policy framework. But for now, we'll talk about kind of studies of power. And so if you think of that word manipulation, it might describe the idea that someone is getting someone else to do something they wouldn't otherwise do. And there are lots of those kind of phrases in power analysis about the power to get someone to do something they wouldn't otherwise do. Now, in this case, you might be talking about exploiting people's beliefs, or exploiting their lack of knowledge about the world, or exploiting their inability to identify their own interests and pursue their own interests. Now, that's not a big visible battle. That is some people persuading other people to act against their own interests. You know, so that is the kind of classic Marxist type analysis of the working classes, and picked up by people like Lux, that said, you know, if only people knew their real interest, they would do something about it. And so the kind of manipulative form of power is to make sure that people, you know, just don't come to that conclusion. Or, so Lux is often associated with the third, you know, the so-called third dimension of power, and the kind of agenda setting was the second face of power. And I think there was a lot of number inflation in this field, you know, so I think some people would talk about Foucault as the fourth dimension. No one ever claimed the fifth. Maybe in my career I'll try and go for the fifth one, but Foucault's often the fourth. Because the idea there is that that power is the ability to encourage social norms. So that you have norms about what is normal behaviour, and therefore what is deviant behaviour. And those norms are enforced in lots of different ways, sometimes by the state, you know, through criminal justice or, you know, mental health services. Sometimes they're enforced by social groups who let people know if they're behaving normally or deviantly. Deviantly. In a deviant manner. Or sometimes, I mean, I think the big thing associated with Foucault is that sometimes it's individuals themselves who are governing themselves. People, as individuals, work out what they think is normal and deviant behaviour, and then they moderate their own activity. And I think the phrase often tied to that is governmentality. You know, so if you're trying to find that form of power, it couldn't be further away from, you know, a highly visible battle between identifiable people. You find it in the body or the mind of individuals. And therefore, it seems almost impossible to research. So instead you rely on kind of conceptualizing this form of power. Now sometimes people say that, you know, these beliefs about what is normal or deviant or such like, they're so ingrained or taken for granted that some people describe them as social structures. You know, relatively fixed, and they provide huge constraints on individuals. Whereas others emphasize this idea that, you know, if such beliefs are taken for granted, it doesn't always require manipulation to take them forward, or you don't require the identification of manipulation to find unequal power relationships. You can simply say that some social rules or some dominant beliefs help some people win in life at the expense of other people, and they do so by luck or design. You know, so you can follow up this idea, you know, the power is often manipulation by design. There's also literature that says, you know, some people are just systematically lucky. You know, if you add up everyone's beliefs, find dominant beliefs, some people benefit from them much more than other people. Okay, and you can go into lots of examples of that kind of, those kind of forms of power. I'll put up one of these kind of 500 words posts soon, and there's a couple of examples you know, that seem worth getting into in more detail. And these are cases where you're identifying the mutually reinforcing effect of observable and less observable forms of power. So I guess the first one might be, you would say, men tend to dominate elected positions. So I'll give you the link to the, there's a kind of record of this, and it's something like, I tried to come up with the most memorable statistic on this, and I think it was, you know, more than 70% of the world's legislatures have 70% of or more men in them, or something like that. You know, just to give you a sense of, men tend to dominate elected positions. They tend to be incumbent in these positions. There are often norms of, you know, gender roles in public life, which encourage men more than women to engage in elected activity. And those two things reinforce each other. You know, men are already in elected positions, so there's clearly a kind of a highly visible exercise of power to do so. There are also kind of dominant beliefs about how men and women should behave in public life, and those two things reinforce each other. And if you're being kind of, if you want to extend that, you would say one of the effects is that some issues are socialized and some issues are privatized. You know, there are some issues that are seen as the private affairs of people within family life, whereas some issues are seen as worthy of public policy attention. And I think you can connect all of those things in a kind of coherent discussion of gender and power. The other example worth following up is this, there's a phrase, I think it's quite popular, or at least I've seen it more and more, is this phrase epistemic violence, which kind of sounds, I think it takes a bit of time to understand and see where it came from. You know, epistemes, you know, I think the etymology is to do with, you know, forms of knowledge, the forms of gathering knowledge. So it seems incongruous, this idea of kind of knowledge-based violence, but it describes this idea that of an act of dismissing an individual or a social group or a population by undermining the value of their knowledge or their claim to knowledge. Okay, so you've got kind of classic examples. I think probably the most kind of frequently described example now is a kind of the idea of a kind of colonial West subjugates colonized populations and diminishes voices of people within those populations. And so there is this literature that we don't really get into, but is worth following up on the idea of a subaltern, which is, you know, people in marginalized and powerless positions and their inability to find a voice and therefore make any claims to knowledge. A kind of more mainstream discussion would be about the idea that some people exercise power to privilege scientific knowledge and dismiss knowledge claims via things like personal experience or shared experience or practitioner knowledge and that sort of thing. And then there are examples of, you know, in particular, you know, women of colour who are sort of erased from, you know, history of women's activism or intellectual history. You know, so these are all examples that people sometimes describe as epistemic violence. You're exercising power by completely dismissing the claims of people to knowledge, and you know, or establishing your claim to knowledge at the expense of someone else. And you know, that's the kind of, if you go back to the way we started, one of the most kind of worrying or profound forms of power is to completely dismiss the words that people speak in favour of your own. Now, when we go on to talk about kind of critical policy research, I think that's the context in which we describe it, because some type of research can be described as kind of positivist with some kind of claim to scientific objectivity, and it's all about kind of establishing general laws from the world. Now, it contrasts with so-called critical research, which is designed to produce social change. So people talk about, you know, this is research for empowerment, for enlightenment and emancipation, based on the idea that you know, that powerless can relate to, you know, things like a lack of material resources, but also the lack of an opportunity to be heard by other people or to work out how to mobilize. Okay, so, we're kind of halfway there. So that's bounded rationality connects with power knowledge, which connects to narrative policy framework. So if you read more on a narrative policy framework, the context is very much bounded rationality and cognitive shortcuts. You know, that's what they're trying to describe. How do people deal with bounded rationality? Well, they say they largely deal with it by telling stories to each other. You know, people humans are naturally storytelling. Oh, what's the word? I've already used humans. Storytelling people. A narrative can be an effective way to respond to bounded rationality. Okay, that's the kind of setup. But it's within a particular context that's worth bearing in mind. And they sometimes emphasize this themselves. So one understanding of that is that some people are vulnerable to manipulation if they rely on others to tell them stories to help them understand the world. You imagine one population listening to the story of another person, another population, and being manipulated as a result. The other way to think about this is, because of the way in which people use cognitive shortcuts, they're actually resistant to a lot of manipulation because they don't pay attention to or trust many sources of information. So I guess you get that. I think when people use the phrases like, we're in bubbles, you know, social media bubbles, you choose your sources of information, and you're only subject to manipulation from a small group of people. I think the phrase that I like to sum up is, we focus on the stories people tell, but they compete with the stories people tell themselves. Okay, so in other words, you know, a story can be a big hit or a big flop, depending on the audience. And I think for me, it's often the audience that matters more than the story. You know, something can really pay off for one audience that already believes you and really fall flat on its face if they don't. Okay. But they get into trying to measure the strategies of people telling stories and trying to exploit others' cognitive biases or influence them by telling them something simple. And the key bit is a narrative contains four elements. And these are the four elements they use to identify a narrative as a coherent thing and to measure its impact. So the first thing it has is a setting, which relates to policymaking context. So the things like institutional context or socioeconomic factors, they refer to some kind of setting. So I guess if you relate to the kind of useful example of tobacco I gave, it's, you know, something like the setting might be, you know, smoking is the biggest cause of preventable death in the world. You know, that's how you would use a particular story for a setting. The second would be character. So it contains at least one actor, a hero, villain, beneficiary or victim, but increasingly these studies are identifying more characters. Then as a plot with a story arc. So I don't know if you read that, this might be just me, but you can Google this, how many story arcs are there in the world ever? And it's seven or something like that. And it's, the classics would be, you know, a hero goes on a journey, they face and then overcome adversity. And the adversity is often caused by a villain. It causes trouble to a victim, sympathetic victim, and it all works out at the end or something like that. You know, there's a kind of, there's these story arcs. Man in a Hole used to be a description of one of them. You know, you would, you know, be three parts. You'd identify with a character. Their life would go horribly wrong in the middle of the story, and then by the end, it all worked out. Okay. And then finally, there'd be a moral. So that a moral would be a story's take-home point, or the thing you would want to do with the story. So, you know, we must reward the heroic campaigner or punish the villainous corporation or protect the victim and such like. Okay. Now, as described, you can imagine that these narratives are connected to wider strategies or concepts. So, for example, people use these narratives to socialize or privatize issues, to describe them as worthy of government attention or not, or to use them to romanticize their own coalition's aims or demonize other coalitions, or they use them to encourage governments to distribute government benefits to some populations who are heroic and to punish populations who are villainous. Okay. Now, the thing is, if you look into these studies themselves, they suggest you can identify the kinds of strategies that help them be effective. So they're effective when they work out an audience's beliefs and they use their fundamental beliefs to influence their more malleable beliefs. I don't know if that makes complete sense, but imagine, you know, people have a whole bunch of contradictory beliefs. So the story is there to find the one they attach most importance and use that one to undermine the others. Okay. I mean, it's not always intuitive, that one, so it's worth following up. They also find that stories tend to be more impactful if they tie them to a hero rather than a villain. So I think, you know, maybe intuitively you think, okay, the most impactful story is to identify a villainous corporation as the cause of a problem, but they find it's often a more positive story that, you know, based on hope, people will respond to. The other ones, I guess, would seem more obvious. You help the audience imagine a concrete problem rather than something abstract, because we pay more attention to things that we can imagine. And they connect individual stories to a big grand narrative. So we sort of talked about that before. You know, a big narrative about you know, what are the kind of key principles in a population that we should adhere to. Okay, but then if you look at these studies some more, you find that a lot of this depends on the audience and the context. So, for example, you might talk about a window of opportunity in which the audience is receptive to that story. Or if you look at historical studies, you'll find a story that really works now had no chance of working 10, 20 years ago. Or you focus on the same story works on a left-wing audience and not on a right-wing audience, or vice versa. And that is, there are a lot of these studies about how stories based on trying to gain your attention, emotional attention to an individual, they work with left-wing populations who will empathize with that person's plight, but they don't work with right-wing populations who judge that person and think they would have done better. But the thing that I can remember is that when they do these studies, they find the biggest short-term impact is on the audience that's already predisposed to accept the story you're telling them. These stories are not changing people's hearts and minds. They are reinforcing people's existing beliefs. And that, you know, intuitively that doesn't sound too important then, if that's all you're doing. But, you know, that reinforcement of people's beliefs can make the difference between thought and action. You know, so the classic example of that is when people go round people's houses before election day, they're focusing their attention on people who already support them. They're not going to their door to change their minds. They're going to their door to make sure they vote. Yeah, so that is reinforcing their beliefs and giving them some motivation to act on them. Okay. Or it's, you know, getting people to pay attention to one issue at the expense of the rest. So it can be a powerful tool to tell a story to reinforce people's beliefs enough to you know, to motivate them, rather than, you know, someone kind of, you know, turning around their very view in life. Okay, so finally is social construction and policy design. Now, I should say this is a quite a specific description of a specific literature. I don't know if I've said it before, but you know, social construction is a very broad discussion, and policy design is a very broad discussion. But the phrase social construction and policy design refers, at least to me, to the work by people like Schneider and Ingram. Okay, so you know, so you could, if you know, that helps us narrow our search a little bit. But they focus on high salience and low salience issues, primarily high salience, and they tell this story of going from bounded rationality to kind of profound policy effects. Okay, in a series of steps. First step is, political actors like elected politicians compete with each other to tell stories that assign praise or blame to target populations. So for example, politicians refer to value judgments about who should be rewarded by government or punished by government. They base these stories on stereotypes of target populations in one or both of the following ways. They exploit the ways that people think about other groups. So they do it strategically. They find out what are the big social stereotypes and how can I exploit them. Or they themselves make emotional and superficial judgments and they back them up with a selective use of facts. So they actually have some kind of emotional connection. They feel pride in some groups and disgust with others. And then they talk about a kind of feedback or feed-forward effect in that these choices are reproduced in policy design. You know, policies, practices, institutions of government. And these policy designs can endure for decades. And the distribution of rewards or sanctions is cumulative and difficult to overcome. Okay, and that kind of design has an impact on citizens. People who feel rewarded by government feel that there's some reason for them to engage in politics to help support the very policies that protect them. They engage to protect the policies that protect them. People who are treated badly by government feel alienated and don't see the reward for their participation. So it actually reinforces their exclusion. So many people know they'll be treated badly, so they become dispirited. Others feel empowered. Then they talk about some groups have the power to challenge or reinforce this image, and it produces four different categories. To describe people who are described positively or negatively, and people who are powerful or powerless. Okay, so if groups are powerful and described positively, then their category is advantaged. They're treated positively in public and they receive benefits publicly. I don't know what kind of group springs to mind there. It's often, for example, small business owners, treated as salt of the earth and they have some kind of resources to reinforce it. Groups who are powerful and described negatively are contenders. So they're treated negatively in public, but they can negotiate government benefits privately. They have the power to do so. So I think often that can be, maybe big businesses would be there. Sometimes they're advantaged, but sometimes they're treated negatively in public, but they can negotiate things behind the scenes. Then you have groups that are powerless but described positively, and their category is dependents. So they're treated positively by government in public, but they're not able to mobilise or otherwise act to negotiate benefits. So they're treated positively, but they can't exploit it particularly well. So often that would be, I think, some of these categories about people who are receive social security benefits, but are dependent on governments to portray them in a particular way. And the final category is deviants. So treated negatively in public and they're punished in policy. So the worst of both worlds. So the most obvious target population in this category, it tends to be related to terrorism or criminal justice, or people who are treated as requiring social security assistance, but not able to secure it and not treated positively by government. Okay. Then they talk to some extent about low salience issues, in which they tend to be treated through bureaucracies, and bureaucracies rely on experts. Okay, so you've got kind of, you've got these high salience issues that reward some populations and alienate others, and then you've got a kind of bureaucratic politics which also alienates those citizens. You know, so the bureaucratic arena is no better for the people who are excluded. Okay, so those are kind of four key terms and approaches. And I think throughout the course, we'll think about how to put those things together. I think for now, we'll say four things. The first is that I think the phrase bounded rationality, it sounds like, well, it feels like to me we talk about it all the time, and it also seems quite innocuous. You know, it doesn't, bounded rationality, I think, just sounds like a kind of technical term. But really, I think its importance is the connection to power. So it's about how people deal with bounded rationality, you know, through manipulation, through generating attention to some issues and ignoring others, through sort of dominating the way in which we understand the world, and through things like trust and expertise. Now, these all arise from our lack of ability to process much information. The third thing is the power of narrative or storytelling within that context. So if people primarily communicate through narrative, people exercise power through those narratives, which is one part the construction of a persuasive story, and one part the stories that people already tell themselves. And the fourth thing is that people address bounded rationality very quickly by assigning praise to some populations and blame to other populations. And those quick and emotional choices or strategic choices have profound consequences. You know, so you can go very quickly from the idea that people cannot process much information very quickly to the idea that the consequence is that they romanticize some populations and demonize others. Okay, so the connection between rationality and power and huge consequences should be quite clear.